Gentlemen, I am the host of Independent Thought. My name is Desmond Price. No matter where you are in the world, I want to thank you for giving me a few minutes of your day to hear my thoughts. As always, we have a great show for you today. Now, here are our topics. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Independent Thought. My name is Desmond Price. For today's episode, I am joined by congressional candidate Sass out of Texas. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I really appreciate you bringing me on. This is I'm so excited for this.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. As I've told a lot of people in my audience, we are doing candidate episodes once a month here for the entire of season four. So Sass is our congressional candidate for this particular month, for the month of August. So I just want to kind of dive right into a little bit of personal questions here, Sass. Could you just tell me specifically, why are you deciding to run for Congress, and why Congress and not a different position?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a laundry list of reasons why I'm running. There's no like single thing, but I will give kind of the catalyst as to what made me run, and then I'll dive a little bit deeper into like why Congress specifically. So, you know, last year, what year is it? Yeah, last year, when COVID really hit mid-March, I got laid off from both of my jobs. They were both serving gigs, restaurants, local restaurants, and a day apart from each other. And then I was just sitting at home, you know, and I'm by no means the exception, just watching the country collapse in real time in front of my eyes. And I was like, you know what? I can do something about this. And so I'm doing something about it. I think I was always destined to get into politics, but it was just, you know, when was that time going to be? And, it's kind of interesting when we start talking about like why U.S. House specifically is like very much the stars aligned. Like there's a lot of luck plays into this. I don't want to ignore that piece of it. I'm very much in the right place at the right time. So I moved to Austin a couple years ago, kind of to find my next chapter in life. So I've been here for a while. I think I found it. But then this kind of opportunity came up because every 10 years we do the census, and then there's a reapportionment of U.S. House seats. And Texas has just been growing so much. You know, we were very confident Texas was going to pick up multiple seats. And right. Austin had grown more than any other city in the country over the last decade. So because of the way that population distribution, pretty confident one of these brand new seats was going to be near where I live. And turns out I can run in any district in the state. There's actually very few restrictions on running for a U.S. House. Like it's easy to qualify for because it's all codified in the Constitution. So the states can't mess with it. Mm. And so that was like part of it. And it was like, cool, now I can run in a district with no incumbent, which like actually means there's like a real chance that I could win. But also like, I really wanted to run on something that was more unifying and more universal and like really building on solutions that include all people. And that's difficult to do when there's an incumbent because you're very much running against the incumbent, whether you're primarying them or you're going up against them in the general, either way, you're running against an incumbent. Like there's that piece of it, but also like I went through an exercise with myself of like, I basically wrote like a 45 minute stump speech. It's not very good, but just as like a practice just to get my thoughts down about things. And I like recorded it and I sent it to some friends and family. And what I realized that process is that like, I am particularly passionate about national issues. And I'm not going to win a race on issues that I'm not passionate about. So running for a national seat also felt right in that capacity as well. When I said, I can do something about it, like that also ties into just like the fortune and opportunity that I've had in my life, like my age. I'm young enough. I had a chance to just throw 2 years into this. So I'm just taking the opportunity the best I can. So that's really, you know, like I said, there's a lot of things that kind of have stormed together to make this a reality. But I really do feel that I have a unique opportunity here. And so I'm seizing it.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things I'm always preaching in my podcast about being politically active, politically motivated. And it's always interesting to me what those events are that, you know, kind of create that political, I guess, incentivization into people. So was there a specific moment for you where you felt like that was the event that led you to becoming more politically active in general? Was there a single moment, or have you kind of always wanted to be involved in politics your entire life?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there was. So at one point I had considered moving out of the country. I was like, I don't want to deal with this bull crap. I could probably like get a work visa in New Zealand or whatever. And I was like thinking about that. And then COVID hit and it was like, so I'm stuck here now. But it was also like, there was a shift during like watching what was going on, as well as seeing opportunity at the same time, you know, having the opportunity to really reflect now that I wasn't working all day, every day, of like, man, it's not like me to like leave people behind. And that's what I feel like I would have done if I had moved out of the country. And so there was kind of this big shift of like, no, I'm not going to leave this country behind and the people I care about, particularly because I can't do something about it. Like, I know a lot of people aren't as fortunate, aren't in the same situation and maybe can't do as much, don't have the same kinds of opportunities that I have. But I took a look in and I discovered that there was this opportunity and I was like, damn, I would totally regret it if I didn't seize this to try to make the world a better place. And it's been really incredible because as I've gone throughout this, I've learned more and more about like the level of impact that I could have is bigger than I originally anticipated, which is also really cool. Or at least I should say the potential, you know, who knows what's actually going to happen. I can't predict the future. But that led into political activism when I was like, all right, I'm going to run. I was like, I need to get politically active too. Like that needs to be part of this. And so I did start getting to political activism in a variety of capacities, you know, and the things that interested me. And I'm glad I did that. I've been getting good experience and doing a variety of things. But there was like a pivotal instance last year during 2020, July 25th. I just kind of accidentally ended up in my first ever march, which was super cool. And then I watched Garrett Foster get shot on the streets in downtown Austin. And that was crazy. And long story short, you can look it all up yourself, but I ended up being effectively like the person who got the story out there in the media and did all the interviews to make sure that the story was told and told properly. And that felt very powerful to me. I mean, yeah, 15 minutes of fame, but I had a national platform where I got to say some things. And it also led to me learning more about like different perspectives and like hearing from people all over the country about like how they disagreed with some of the things that I said. And it opened up my perspective on like, man, if I really want to build a campaign that includes all people, like I need to rethink some of this. And so, you know, it's kind of continued from there, but yeah, I mean, it all ties together is really what it comes down to.
Right. You told me previously when we spoke that you thought that while it was important to become politically, you know, like activated, that there was kind of a bad side of political activism. Could you expand a little bit more on that? What exactly did you mean by that? And what exactly happened that led you to feel that way?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I read you a short bit of a transcript or like of a thing that I wrote about that. So beyond, you know, I watched Garrett get shot. I did these interviews. I ended up on a live show on CNN, Cuomo Primetime. Before the interview ended, I made a point of like delivering a message of, and I quote, "If Black lives mattered in this country, we would still have Garrett today." What followed was, you know, over a couple of days, I got a lot of support from people all over the country. But over the following month, I received a lot of vitriol, and I didn't understand why. You know, like I said, I was already running for Congress, but so what happened was I continued to protest after that. I continued to march and do some of this ground level activism, but I did over time become detached from like the ground level protesting, because I kept trying to spread messages of unity and positivity, but others were leading those marches by tapping into tribal anger. When I found an opportunity to engage peacefully with some opposition in the crowd, it was smothered by mob mentality that surrounded us. Right. I felt that the asphalt was not where my energy would be most effective. And so I've mostly shifted my focus to my campaign. It's not that I never march anymore. But from there, you know, I've spoken to thousands of Texans from all over the state and political spectrum, seeking to, you know, trying to take in their perspectives, you know, learn about what they care most about. And I mean, it's through that process that I've really come to internalize that political divisions, like they really are manufactured. We're all human. We all got similar needs and desires. This was really powerful and profound for me that like, it's not that I don't believe in your right to march or your right to, you know, protect yourself or whatever, but, you know, and your right to free speech and all that. It's just that I personally found that for me, I felt that my energy would be more efficient and more effectively directed in other areas. You know, particularly because I was trying to run on this message of unity. And it felt like the marches, at least the ones that I was attending, so often were getting just as divisive as anything else we were experiencing at the time.
Right. And you know what, actually that's a great segue, because you told me that one of the like pillars of your campaign is like directly addressing division. Could you tell me a little bit more about that, and how exactly would you plan to do that, you know, like if elected?
Yeah, so there's some things I want to do both like legislatively and outside of legislation. So like just this concept of division, sometimes people ask me like, what do you mean by division? I mean, just like generally. People not being able to like, I've talked to so many people who have like lost contact with friends or family over because they disagree on like some political issues or whatever, and they feel like they can't talk to each other anymore. And, you know, this is a result of actual like centuries of like mechanics and systems that have incentivized polarity instead of consensus. One of them is our choose one voting system, which we'll talk about later.
Right.
That systematically polarizes people. Another aspect is more recently is our news and opinion has merged. So it used to be that in the newspaper there was a hard news section and there was an opinion section.
Right.
And then we had another thing. We had fairness doctrine, which required that on opinion shows that you needed to give an equal amount of time to opposing sides. So what we've seen happen is like fairness doctrine has been dismantled. And actually, this, if you look into the history of fairness doctrine, it's really only been just like a select few people who happen to be in positions of power who have managed to keep it shot down. So like, it's absolutely possible that we could bring it back. There have been many attempts before. I think that that's a really important thing. So legislatively, one of the things I want to do is cleanly define what counts as press. So let me back up. our media from Fox to Facebook is not incentivized to spread information. This is the other piece of it. They're incentivized to make money. And these media companies have found that the best way to make money is to spread misinformation and lies and propaganda to divide people into echo chambers to get us angry at each other and this glues us to our screens to get more eyes on ads. We actually have we have a term for this, doom scrolling. But so cleanly defining what counts as press, if we put this briefly in the context of the First Amendment, I believe in freedom of speech for individuals, and I believe in freedom of the press. But when I think of freedom of the press, I think of freedom of information, not freedom of misinformation. Now, there is no algorithm for truth, but if we can separate the interpretation and the political commentary and the entertainment into this other category, and then apply the fairness doctrine to it that I was just talking about, we can come back to the press side of things, and we can work to decouple press from the profit motive. News stations used to be the kings of loss. I think that was a Bill Maher quote, actually. But now it's all like they gotta make money. So I have a couple ideas around how we can do this, but my favorite idea that I've come up with is journalism vouchers. So basically, we would give every American, say, $120 a year, and they can spend this money, but only on subscription journalism. And the whole point of that is to help increase journalism that isn't tied to a profit motive. And so doesn't have that kind of incentive to just like divide and split and do these echo chambers. Of course, you know, this ties in with universal basic income. It ties in with my government accountability, like social media platform I want to build based on donations and have like a balanced engine. Like the other things I want to do, like low conditionality funding for local and investigative and independent journalism, and we can have like matching grants for municipalities to help fund local journalism. But I think this journalism voucher program, I really, really like this. And so that's within legislation, but outside of legislation, another thing I wanna do, let me say just real quick, one of the main effect of those programs would be a decentralization of sources and narratives. So Americans would have more ways to discover information about their communities without having to focus on centralized media narratives. All of these categories, by the way, would require full disclosure at the beginning of each article or show. So like a television channel, if they're gonna have on a show that's like political commentary, then at the beginning of it, they need to say, this is not news or whatever it ends up being. But then a news show, they say, this is news. And so this helps to give people better information about the type of content that they're consuming and empowers them to make better choices. But outside of legislation, I do have one other thing I'm trying to do. It's proving to be more difficult than I expected, but throughout and beyond my campaign, I'm gonna host weekly live streams where I bring on someone who disagrees with me and then we'll just talk. People are sick of the screaming matches on cable. They're craving this, right? So they're because they want to remember what it's like to have a conversation with someone they disagree with. Nobody likes losing friends and family over stupid identity politics and labels and terminology we don't even agree on the definition of anymore. I'm fed up with people saying we need to come together while turning around and driving more division. I want to demonstrate. I'm going to actually show how to have that kind of a conversation. And I think it's really important for people to see that. Long form content, I want it to be live so the audience can interact with each other, but while watching a one-on-one conversation where supposedly one of us is gonna say things that really pisses them off, but watch how the other person, or you know, at least for me, the other person says something crazy that really pisses off somebody in the audience. Like I want that person in the audience to watch how I handle that in a way that allows the conversation to continue being productive and to get to more root pieces and or more root issues that in a way that again helps to build consensus rather than drive division. And so this is, you know, if nothing else, I want to accomplish, you know, just starting like a snowball effect of like relentless patience and kindness for our fellow Americans. So this is kind of my whole thing of like, I have other things I want to do that kind of indirectly address division, but I just feel the timeline, you know, like we got to hit on this directly. And so that's what that's about.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to explain that for us. Now, I think one more question that I want to get to kind of around what you were just referring to is universal basic income. You had just referenced the fact that that is kind of intertwined with so many of the other policies that you are also very adamant about. So this idea was kind of popularized by Andrew Yang when he ran for president in the last election cycle. And so I've seen a lot more people come out in support of this now. Some people are very much against it. The arguments are, you know, it's going to make people lazy, so on and so forth. But this is something that's very important to you. So could you explain to, you know, like us, the audience, why universal basic income is necessary? And why do you think it's going to be an overall benefit to society?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I'm so used to talking with crowds and people who like are already super in favor of UBI. So it's kind of funny. If you look at all my other interviews I've done, I actually don't talk about UBI that much for that reason. Right now we have an epidemic of poverty, you know, and it's like, I don't buy the kind of like numeric definition of poverty that we use of like $12,400 a year or whatever it is. Like, to me, poverty is when money becomes more important than your time. It's when you are becoming, when your basic needs are not secure, right? Housing, food, healthcare, and you start to succumb to scarcity mentality, right? So you enter survival mode. And the effect that this has is it takes up space in your brain. It's like just survival is just takes up a lot of your mental capacity. It dramatically reduces how your level of productivity and what you can do and accomplish. And that's why we talk about people getting stuck in ruts. That's why we talk about things like generational poverty, you know, and it really negatively affects health outcomes. I mean, it negatively affects everything. The whole thing about poverty, what is poverty? Poverty is just a lack of cash. In a society where everything revolves around the dollar, I'm not saying I like that system, but that is the reality of the system that we live in. The simplest and most effective way, at least in the United States, that we can secure people's basic needs is to write them a check. And what that will do is it will pull millions of people out of poverty, and it will unlock their potential and allow them to become more productive and contribute more to their communities and to society. It has a whole bunch of effects. There's so many, I mean, the reasons are endless. Look up Scott Santons. He writes about this stuff all the time. But I mean, it will give people more leverage to demand better wages at jobs, as well as refusing jobs that human beings shouldn't be doing in the 21st century. Andrew Yang talked a lot about automation, AI, robots taking jobs. Like, that's very real. Like, that's absolutely a reason. I think jobs are a 20th century concept that we need to leave behind in the past. We need to say labor is for machines and life is for people, and give people the freedom to choose what they want to do with their time, as well as start recognizing the other types of work that we do, right? Expanding our definition of work. So including things like child rearing, family care, volunteering, freelance work, artistry. These are all important things that people do that contribute to our society. We don't pay for it. So this is a way to start paying for those things. You know, there are, it allows people to invest in their own communities and start businesses, give people more opportunities to explore different things that they want to do. You know, but I also want to address, I think it's really always good to address like specific concerns that people have, because this does touch so many things.
Yeah.
So the one you brought up is, will it make people lazy? And so the answer is no. Regardless of the fact that all of the data that we have on every basic income trial done throughout the world since forever, right? We're talking about dozens and dozens of trials from California to Kenya, has shown that productivity increases. But the actual crux of it is, we have over 90 federal welfare programs. And the Achilles heel of all of them is that they are conditional. And those conditions are incentives. If you have to jump through a whole bunch of hoops and do all these things in order to get this money that you need to survive, make sure that you can pay rent, you don't get evicted and die on the street like thousands of other homeless people in America do every year, then you're going to do whatever those hoops are. So, for example, standard welfare, if you make a cent over, once you hit $1,000 a month on your job, you lose the entirety of your welfare benefits. So now you are incentivized against getting a raise or getting a promotion or taking on more hours or getting another job. Why would we incentivize people not to do that? Right? But if you remove the condition, this Achilles heel of it, and you just give people money unconditionally, now they are free to actually do things and they're not tied down. They don't have these incentives. So I very much think that this relic of having over 90 federal welfare programs that are broken and bureaucratic and dehumanizing and miss millions of Americans, like, I am not married to that. It's not working. We need something that is simpler, that isn't going to miss people, and that is actually going to unlock those things. But I'd love to give an opportunity for you to bring up other concerns that people have.
Right. And I think that there'll probably be some time for that here in a little bit. But the first thing that we're going to do is take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have the second half of our conversation with Sass. Stay tuned.
Hey, Indie Thought listeners. Has this past year helped you rediscover your creative and crafty side? Well, then you're going to love our sponsor for today's episode, Bathing Beauties Beads is a full-service bead shop in the heart of downtown Missoula. Whether it's seed beads, semi-precious stones, vintage beads, or just materials to make a project, they have something for every person and every price range. Not from Missoula? Don't worry. They have an extensive online store and they will ship directly to you. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, they'll welcome you and help you make your next project a reality. You can find them online at Bathing Beauties Beads on Instagram and Facebook, or at bathingbeautiesbeads.com. And don't forget to use offer code INDEPENDENTTHOUGHT at checkout to save 15% on your order.
Betty's Divine is a locally owned boutique on the magnificent Hip Strip in downtown Missoula, Montana, that has been a fixture in the Mountain West since 2005. We have a fondness for vintage-inspired clothing, shoes, and accessories for humans, as well as the real deal found in our vintage department, Divine Trash. Betty's Divine presents a snapshot of Northwest styles with an emphasis on street, skate, surf, and rock and roll culture, as well as Americana classics. Alongside a radical selection of clothing, Betty's Divine offers a damn fine array of shoes, jewelry, records, and accessories to satisfy any taste, whatever your age or vibe. You can count on us to prioritize financial, social, and environmental responsibility without sacrificing the look. Visitors enjoy a lovely atmosphere, dreamy tunes, and the best customer service in the West, and you can shop us online at bettysdivine.com.
Welcome back from the break, everyone. Thank you for sticking with us through this episode of Independent Thought. So before we were going on the break, we were speaking a little bit about universal basic income as like one of the issues that you are very, very concerned with. Just, you know, that it seems like it's intertwined with the rest of your platform. But again, in one of our previous conversations, another thing that you told me that you were very passionate about was election science. And we, you know, had a conversation about star voting and ranked choice voting. You know, we're starting to see ranked choice voting pop up in different states around the country. Over in New York City, it was just implemented. So I want to ask you a little more specifically, why is election science so important to you? And then on top of that, why is star voting something that you are, I guess, very adamant about, I guess, more so than other forms of voting?
Yeah. So more specifically than election science, it's voting method reform, very, very specifically. And there are two methods primarily that I advocate for, and those are star voting and approval voting. There are other great methods: score voting, 3-2-1 voting, Smith score, a variety of Condorcet methods. But the two primary recommendations for the United States right now are star voting and approval voting. But yeah, so this is like, how do I put this? So the way that people in power are chosen is the most consequential mechanic of how a nation operates. So currently in the US and in many other wealthy democratic nations, we primarily choose government officials through a process, a voting method called choose one voting, which is exactly what you're familiar with, where every citizen gets to make one mark per race on their ballot to show support for a single person to represent them in government. The problem is choose one voting is one of the worst voting methods ever created. So choose one voting systematically polarizes people, feeding this toxic idea that we can only advocate for like one group or one set of ideas at a time. And this contributes to the dreaded spoiler effect that you've probably heard of, where similar voters split their votes between two similar candidates, potentially causing both of them to lose and allowing a third candidate to win who may be disliked by all of those similar voters. Fear of this mechanical problem that's baked into choose one voting leads to the strategic lesser evil voting we find ourselves constantly hearing about, and an inevitable, unavoidable trend toward a two-party system that we have found ourselves stuck in. It's the math of the method, not a vice of the voters. So like I said, there's dozens of different voting methods to choose from. Star voting and approval voting are the two I advocate for. So I'll tell you first about star voting. So I like to describe star voting as the ultimate culmination of modern voting science. So STAR is an acronym. It stands for score, then automatic runoff. And that's exactly how it works. So what happens is you score all of your candidates from 0 to 5 stars on your ballot independently of each other. So you can have multiple candidates of the same score. You can draw bigger differences between them. You do whatever you want. And then we add up all the scores for all the candidates across all the ballots. The two candidates with the highest scores become finalists who move on to the automatic runoff. So then what happens is whichever of those two candidates you scored higher on your ballot, that finalist gets your one full vote. And then whichever finalist gets the most votes wins. And this produces astoundingly accurate results for a whole bunch of wonderful mathematical scientific simulation reasons. I'm not going to get into it right now, but I highly recommend that you do. You check it out, starvoting.us, Equal Vote Coalition, all that. But it produces really, really great results that are incredibly accurate. Of course, when we think about, you know, political reform, we always have to live in the real world. And so when we look at star voting specifically, we can run into roadblocks at times. For a jurisdiction that a small jurisdiction that doesn't have a lot of money to spend on on redesigning ballots or retraining poll workers or some big voter education campaign, or if it has some like wonky election code, star voting can be a really hard sell, which is why I also advocate for approval voting. Now, before I move on to approval voting, I just want to make sure, does star voting seem clear, like what it is and how it works?
I'm sure that mostly everyone at home is following right along.
Awesome. Sweet. So approval voting is comically simple, right? So it's changing the language on the ballot from choose one to choose one or more. And that's it. So it's instead of just bubbling in next to one candidate on your ballot, you're free to bubble in next to as many candidates as you like or all the candidates you approve of. And then the tabulation is exactly what you're familiar with. You just count up all the votes or all the approvals, and whoever gets the most approvals wins. And this also produces really great results. They're not quite as like dead on accurate as star voting is, but approval voting is about bang for the buck, right? It's in simplicity. So I like to describe approval voting as the highest and fastest return on investment for any voting method shift in the US right now. So star voting doesn't require any change to electoral infrastructure, which makes it a viable sell for small jurisdictions that don't have a lot of money to spend. We saw this in Fargo, North Dakota, and St. Louis, Missouri already, where the taxpayers paid basically nothing to implement it and use it in elections, which is fantastic for them. And it's just, it's the election codes that star voting isn't going to be compatible with, for the most part, approval voting will be compatible with. And also there are places where approval voting will be less viable because it won't be able to eliminate an election, where star voting will be more viable because it can eliminate an election. We actually really need both of these methods. We can't do it with just one of them alone. But with both of these methods, but it's easier to understand with approval voting, is that this that one tiny change, we're just shifting the instructions on the ballot. It has dramatic positive effects on election results that almost completely eliminates the spoiler effect that I was talking about earlier. And it flips the dynamic of our voting from polarity to consensus. That's like the real power of it. But what it really comes down to is the power of the vote. By only allowing you to express support for one candidate at a time under choose one voting, the power of your vote is limited in that exact way. Approval voting, star voting, they unlock the power of your vote, and that leads to better candidates running, better candidates winning, and more accountability for those people in power, our elected officials, who ultimately direct how the nation operates. So I just want to pause and does that all make sense? Sink in? Do you have questions?
I have no questions.
Okay.
All right. So kind of, I'm of the mind where any improvement to our voting system is welcomed by me. I know that it feels as though our system right now kind of like sometimes like disincentivizes people to show up to the polls. And so if there is a system out there that is going to increase people to want to turn out to vote, I'm all for that. But, you know, on top of, you know, what's driving people out to the polls, especially in this upcoming election that I'm thinking about, there's been a lot of energy around the lack of climate change initiatives, which has been a hot button topic, especially this summer, especially out where I live in the Pacific Northwest, where we've seen a lot of wildfire smoke, where we have to deal with that on a day in and day out basis. We've largely not seen any kind of movement whatsoever at the federal level on the climate, I guess, radar, as you would say right now. There is some whispers that there's something in the reconciliation bill, but there's no guaranteeing that it'll make the final cuts as we sit here today. So I want to ask you specifically, if you were elected, how exactly would you address climate change? Like, is there a specific legislation that you have in mind that you would implement if you were in the halls of Congress right now?
Yeah, so there are a couple things here. So I want to first and foremost say that, like, I don't believe that any wealthy government is doing even close to enough to address our environmental crisis. It's a huge problem, as you just said, and I want to like be very straightforward with that. Additionally, though, what I want to stack on top of that is that the scale of this problem is enormous. It is literally unfathomable. It's beyond what we can fit in our puny human brains. 12.6 million people die every year due to unhealthy environments, whether we're talking about poor air quality, famines, droughts, floods, heat waves, snap cold freezes, toxins and pollutants. It's only going to continue to climb. And the thing is, this is going to require sustained action from wealthy governments. There's no single piece of legislation that's going to fix this. And that's really why the pillars of my platform are universal basic income, voting method reform, government accountability, and directly addressing division. These are the roadblocks in the way that are preventing sustained action from wealthy governments. Across administrations, across countries, ensuring that people have the mental capacity to care about the planet as a whole globally and beyond just making it to being able to pay rent, ensuring that the government is being held accountable by actions of the people and that there's a continuous public citizen feedback loop, ensuring that the power of the vote is not smaller than the power of the dollar in elections, and addressing the division that we find all these systems drilling us into. That's all of that is going to be necessary in order to get these wealthy nations to create sustained action. There is no specific piece that I like prioritize over others. There are a huge variety of different things that we need to address. I will say this. I think the biggest thing, I get it. Pollution of our rivers, deforestation, human-led mass extinction, but carbon in the atmospheres and the oceans is the number one issue. And I'm totally into all of the kind of natural ways of decarbonization. But at the end of the day, what we have done artificially is orders and orders of magnitude beyond what nature can do. And so there is going to have to be scaled artificial carbon capture and geologic sequestration. That is taking carbon out of the atmosphere and oceans and storing it deep underground where we got it from in the first place. And there's no market value in that. That's just something wealthy nations are going to have to put up and shut up about. There's no way around it. There's no other way. People talk about carbon markets and trying to make these like economically feasible things. And like, I'm for all that too. I'm for all of the things. There's no, but I just want to like recognize, like, we're just going to have to spend money on that. And also number two is like mitigation and survival. It's going to get a lot worse. And we're going to see deaths really start to climb. Way beyond what they currently are. And as a species, we're going to have to figure out how to live indoors at some point. I don't know when, I don't know how extreme it's going to be, but this is something that a lot of environmental scientists are grappling with and are in grief counseling over, but the public hasn't really recognized yet, which is that we have already passed many critical thresholds and there is no saving it completely. There is no full-on prevention. There is no last minute, we're going to get this right, we're going to pull together. Like, no, we're going to see a lot of death. We're going to see a lot of suffering. And we're going to have to do a lot to, we're going to have some pretty uncomfortable times. Whether it's the summer where food stops growing, or it's flooding of coastal areas where half of the world's population lives. Telling people, look, you move inland. If you don't move inland with this opportunity that we're giving you right now, then when your town gets flooded, we're not going to come get you. And it sucks. And it's very inhumane to say that, but like, there's a certain degree of like, we have this very small slice of time where we have enough abundance to like actually accomplish some things. And I don't know that abundance is going to stick around. This is a key time, and I don't want to make everybody depressed, I fully recognize how big of an issue this is. And I'm on board with all of the things that actually make it better. But I just want to recognize some of those really big issues, particularly artificial carbon capture and sequestration and preparing for disaster.
Okay. I think one of the things that you were touching on there was the role that the federal governments of the world need to be playing in climate change and the actions they need to take, which more or less ties into one of the pillars of your campaign, which is government accountability. So will you just tell me exactly what that means for you? I mean, it's a very broad term that could mean so many different things, but when you say that, when you put that on your website, what exactly does that mean from you on a policy perspective?
Yeah. So one of the things I say is, transparency is irrelevant without accountability, and vice versa. I don't think that our government is all that transparent, but we know that it's not accountable, because when the emails do leak and the recordings do come out, nothing changes. Accountability needs to come from outside of the entity that's being held accountable. So in this case, accountability needs to come from the people. So what I'm doing is I am working with others to build an open source public platform, almost like a social media thing, where constituents in my district can log on, verify their residency, and you know, talk about local politics and interact with each other and do, you know, some like political activism, social media kind of things. But among all that stuff, the main feature is that every time I vote on a piece of legislation, they'll be able to approve or disapprove of my vote on that piece of legislation. So they'll be able to see the legislation, kind of a summary of it or plain English translation of it, why I voted the way I voted, some education about it. But then I will have a public scorecard of how representative I am of my district. This creates a quantified, continuous public feedback loop, which we don't have, right? So right now we have these private channels of emails and phone calls, which can be ignored. We have polling, which is like sparse and like misses a lot of people, and it's very like generalized questions. Just like general overall approval ratings. And then we have elections every 2 or 4 or 6 years that are mired in this rat race, these rat races with all this like money. And it's a one big fat mess with really bad voting too. And so this creates that continuous feedback loop, because that's what accountability really is. And that's just the start. So since it's open source, you know, after all the bugs and the kinks are worked out on me, I'll be the guinea pig. This can be applied to every elected representative in the country without their consent. This doesn't require any participation from elected representatives. Of course, if they want to participate and leverage some of the polling of it, fantastic. But we can help scale this and get more people involved by adding features like proxy voting, where people can choose another person to vote on their behalf on certain topics. We can have national topics of interest that we can then poll at scale. We can combine it with additional polling data performed through more traditional means like phone calls, door knocks, emails, you know, literature, mailers, whatever. And then even actions of politicians outside of their floor votes can go through the same approval disapproval process and be applied to their scorecards. And it can give people like a quick little card of like, all right, you're going to the polls for your election, like how representative is your incumbent of you? And so it gives people, it empowers people. But kind of my favorite part about this is how it can be used to influence existing members of Congress to vote more in line with the desires of their constituents rather than party bosses. So right now in Congress, representatives are very locked down when they're in DC. They're limited as to how much they can communicate with their constituency and what they can bring on the floor and bring to work. And there are a bunch of these lobbyists who spend all their time sweet talking them and telling them not to change anything and to keep the status quo. It's kind of like a roundabout bribery. It's ridiculous. But you know, we also see party bosses like elites who effectively bribe Congress people with money. They say, hey, if you go along with what I say, then if you get primaried, I'll pour $10 million into your campaign or whatever it is. And so what this would allow me to do is to go up to another representative and say, hey, I pulled 10,000 people in your district. 6,000 of them said they voted for you. Of that, 70% said they support my universal basic income bill. Of the 4,000 who voted against you, 80% said they support my universal basic income bill. If you co-sponsor my bill, I will tell all of them for you for free. And so this becomes a sort of 21st century hack to get around the gridlock on Capitol Hill so we can actually begin to get some things done in the interest of the people. And so instead of bribing representatives with money, I'll be bribing them with votes. And so I think that this is a really cool concept. You know, if we leverage some of what we've learned about, you know, social media and mobile games to get people addicted to it, like I have no qualms about like getting people addicted to like being active in their communities and making positive changes and holding the representatives accountable and standing up for what they believe and expressing their opinions. Like, I think that's a good thing. And I'd rather them do that for a platform that is funded by donations rather than having a profit motive and that is public and open source than you know, staring away at a screen. So I see this as a really cool, powerful way that we can start to bring real accountability from the people for representatives in office.
Okay. Well, Sass, I want to thank you so much for giving us, you know, like your feelings on that issue, on all these issues during this episode. Thank you for coming in and talking to all of us. If someone wants to get more involved with you and your campaign, where can they find you at online?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me first off, but yeah, voteforsass.com, VoteForSass.com. That is the central hub to access everything. I just recently finished rewriting all of like updating all my platform and policies and everything. And I should be getting that up on the site very soon. But that's my central hub. So you can get to all my social media from there. You can donate there. You can contact me directly, you know, like privately, or you can go on my social media and contact me publicly. And that's always the place to go. So voteforsass.com, anything you want to find, you'll be able to find it there. And hey, look, if you're listening or watching this, and you're a person who likes long form content about policies and proposals and stuff, I have a ton of content on my YouTube channel. Again, you can get there from voteforsass.com. I think you'll really enjoy my long form content if you've been enjoying this today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Oh, and just, you know, one final question for all the listeners out there. Texas is currently redistricting. So do you know when you might know, I guess when that might be finished?
October, November, it's hard to say. There's no strict deadline. Well, I mean, normally there are deadlines, but they all got basically erased because of COVID, because all the census data got delayed. Right. So yeah, approximately that time. But again, like we don't know where the district is gonna be. Like I said, chances are just based on where the population within the state has moved, there will likely be a district near where I live in Austin. And then I will likely run whatever that new district is.
All right. Well, everyone be on the lookout for that. And those links will be in the episode description. So make sure you just go ahead and go into the description. You'll be able to click on the link to Sass's website. Go and check that out. Thank you again for showing up to the episode today and speaking with all of us. And we're going to take one final break and we'll be right back with my final thoughts of the day. Stay tuned. Welcome back from the break, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode of Independent Thought. So closing out this episode here, I just want to say once again, thank you to my guest, Sass, for coming onto the podcast, explaining his platform, and talking to us about what his vision is for the country and why he's running for Congress in the state of Texas. Now, if you are interested in seeing the video version of this episode, you can join my Patreon. There is a link in the description of this episode. Feel free to click into the description. You can join my Patreon and you can see the video version, not just of this episode, but of all episodes of season 4. All of my guest segments will have video versions through Patreon that you will be able to see. And I want to say thank you to all of my existing patrons for contributing to the podcast each and every month. It's greatly appreciated. I hope you're enjoying these video versions of the episode. For everyone out there, please go ahead and tell me what you thought of this episode. Did you like, you know, our candidate for this month? Tell me what you thought of Sass. Go ahead and send me some feedback about what you thought about him and his platform. And if you were interested in his platform, go ahead and just click on those links in the description again that go to his website. You can get directly in contact with Sass that way. So coming up in the future, we have candidates for September, October, November, and December. So there'll be 4 more of these. before season four is over. And if you have a candidate that you want to hear some more from, go ahead and recommend them to the podcast. Have them reach out if you know them personally, or if you don't know them personally, reach out to me and I'll try to reach out to them. So definitely let me know how you felt about these episodes. There will be some more panel episodes coming up in the not too distant future, so be on the lookout for that. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Independent Thought. We'll see you in the next one.